Welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast. I'm John Vogel, TW's creative director. For today's episode, we have the weird Philadelphia punk band Northern Liberties, who continue to play after 24 years of being in a band. I've played with Northern Liberties in all my main performance projects, as a solo artist, with grandchildren, and with Rad Racket. A staple of the West Philadelphia music scene, the band consists of three members: brothers Justin and Mark Dewar on vocals and drums, and Kevin Riley on bass. In addition to his role in the band, Justin's also a visual artist, producing flyer and album art for the band, as well as murals and pen, ink, and marker pieces outside the context of the group. A solo show of his art, Let the Light Live, is just wrapping up its viewing at NYC's Vander Plas Gallery. The band's most recent album, Self-Dissolving Abandoned Universe, was recorded in March 2022 with the legendary engineer and producer Steve Albini, who passed away in May of 2024. It provides the soundtrack to this episode. I've done some rearrangement of the interview to aid with the flow, starting with the group's background. For voice identification, you'll hear from Kevin first, then Justin, then Mark.
I guess it's relevant to point out that the three of us grew up in the same town.
Which is not a town. It's a no-stoplight town.
Justin and Mark are brothers, and I met them when I was 12. So the way that we're talking about that stuff is a very overlappy thing, because we're overlappy. They're overlappy their entire life, and I'm overlapping from 12 till now. So
what's the name of the town, bud?
Wanksville was where Wanksville. Me and Mark lived.
Okay.
Yeah. And Kevin was from...
I technically lived in Gettysburg by my driving address, but it wasn't
in the town, though.
Yeah, it was probably 10 miles away from it, but that's the way zip codes work in...
Yeah, we were really north of Gettysburg. Places.
You also got to put this all in the context of, like, it's, like, super rural, so there's, like, no... town. And this is all obviously before the internet, so like going to the mall and getting Thrasher magazine.
Yeah, it's like you're talking about the very late 80s, maybe.
Late 80s,
early
90s.
Just cresting
into... I remember
the
when
90s.
The Cure Disintegration came out, and I was like, oh, I think they sold out. You know, it's not as, you know, edgy or something. Because I got the early albums, and I really like those.
So were you guys still around Gettysburg when you moved to Philadelphia?
I think I moved...
Me and Justin, he moved like a month before me.
Yeah. Okay.
Gotcha.
And I'm the youngest of the three of us, so... Okay. I moved probably 2 years later. Yeah, I moved in 96.
Yeah. What happened was there was this kid that Mark knew from like elementary school who was kind of a friend of his who lived down the road from us. And his parents were like, it's funny looking back on it because I saw it as like, oh my God, they're so like overachievers or something. But they just wanted their kid to go to college. You know, we're like, who goes to college? You know? But anyway, he got a scholarship or something to go to Penn. And I don't think he really wanted to. He wanted to find romance, really, was what he wanted in life. I think that what was his true goal was to like start a family or something. But his parents sort of like corralled him into going to Penn, and he went for 2 years, and then he like got a girlfriend and was like dropped out of college and everything. But he was there, so he was like our into Philly. That's why we went to Philly as opposed to like New York or something. I don't know what else we would have done, but. He had some kind of in with a frat house that was actually the frat that Colin Powell had attended when he was in Penn, that's across the street from this place that's now does like music venue called the Rotunda. I don't know if you know where that's at. It's anyway, it's right across from there. It's called Sigma Epsilon, Sig Ep.
Okay.
And he was like, hey, if you guys want to come down to Philly during the summer when the frat is away, they're subletting for $100 a month. You can get a room for 3 months. So... like me and Gary, who was one of our circle of kids who were into punk and metal or whatever, were like, fucking, all right, we're going and getting the $300 a month room. And then you know, while we're there, we're going and we're discovering like squatters and stuff, and we're like, oh, we can live in a squat. Like we, you know, so it's like we did that for summer.
Let me tell you a funny story about the frat house. So these kids were jerks.
I imagine.
They're Penn frat kids, and like if you,
they're not the cool frat. They were like,
yeah, if you see like Elon Musk, they had like his arrogance, that level of like, and they had a pool table, and they would play pool, and they would instantly get in fights with each other, like, bro, I'm not doing what, come on, man, this whole thing. So we were staying there. And they had just come back, and they didn't know me, right, at all. So I didn't have a key to the front door, so what I would do when I would get home...
We were insane.
Now, I had a trench coat, like this long trench coat, and so I would crawl in the window to get into the building, which I would leave open.
And like, why didn't you have a key? Like, we were
well, that's
idiots,
a whole other story. But, so these kids, these... You know, Penn frat kids are playing pool, you know, and there's like eight of them or six of them standing around. And like the window to the room, I climb in the window. They have no idea who I am. I don't say a word to any of them. I just walk right past them and up the stairs to my room. And like, they were just like silent. They were like, as I'm walking through, and I'm like, I get to my room, I'm like, 3, 2, and I do up the steps. I'm like, and they're like, do. Who the hell are you? I'm like, oh, you know, I rent here. You can talk to the guy downstairs. Hold on. And then I hear him going downstairs to the guy that we rented from. Why the hell did you let these assholes move in? Yeah, we got, and then that was like, it was downhill from there. Like I got, the next morning I got woken up and they were like, you stole my mattress. But we did eat.
We lived off cake mix for like a month or something.
Yeah,
nothing but cake mix.
We didn't have any money.
Water and cake mix. That's all we ate.
They had...
before we could figure it out, we could eat out of garbage cans.
They had... I guess they had, like, chefs that cooked for them or whatever. People, like...
Servants.
Servants.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so they had, like, these giant things of cake mix, but they never paid any attention to it because they don't... Why would they ever go to a kitchen? Get into a kitchen. So, yeah, we just
we put water in the cake mix and put it in the microwave.
Put it in the microwave.
And that's all we ate for like a month. You know what I mean?
2 months.
Yeah, 2 months. I mean, we were like human rats. We were just like, oh, we got into the cake mix. You know what I mean? We're bugging out. Oh, my God, we were such idiots. I mean,
we were idiots.
We were so young. You know what I mean?
Like, it sounds extremely resourceful.
I was resourceful. I mean...
You know.
We sort of learned the ropes of squatting and eating out of garbage cans, and then our quality of life went way up. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, man, we found, like, half a pizza in the trash can. You know? Some squatter kid with a face tattoo is like, you dumbass, just eat your pizza out of the garbage can and shoot dope, you know, whatever. So that was a better lifestyle, you know? But,
Yeah, it was.
It was a step up from living off cake mix.
Well, I don't know. It might have been a lateral move.
A lateral move.
So when you guys must have formed the band like around that time, because you've been together for 23 years.
Oh, yeah,
it was after that.
But you don't understand how long ago this is. This is 94.
Yeah, right. About 94. We started the band in 2000.
And it was until the late 90s. I guess it was 97. Me and some friends of mine went down to this abandoned oil refinery where they got these big oil drums, and we went down into the oil drums and recorded down there with a portable 8-track. We did a cover of the Sugar Cubes' Regina. Nice. And put that on YouTube, and the keyboard player from the Sugar Cubes, I forget her name, one time she sent me a YouTube message. She's like, this is the best cover of Regina. Like, this is, you know, because it's not a cover. It's like a very, like, abstract, it's like, sounds like Crash Worship covering.
Yeah, because a lot of the people that would go down into the, I mean, it was a huge oil container.
Like one of the ones in South Philly.
Yeah, it's the size of a building.
With no top on it.
And making it, it was, you know.
And at the bottom, there were
hundreds
like...
hundreds of thousands of gallons.
Yeah, like, there were baffle plates at the bottom. So that's, you know, what we would...
With nunchucks.
We'd get
nunchucks without the chain. Like...
And, you know, half the people, you know, weren't... musicians, we would just be like, yeah, come along.
Well, my friend Cabby was the first one to tell me about it, and he was a crazy face tattoo heaven, like insaniac squatter that was like, one winter he had to eat a cat. He was like living down there. He's like, I fucking eat a cat. But he's the one that first told me about it, he was like, oh, you got to come to this oil refinery. He's like, I bought a tent with Marlboro miles. He's like, I've been getting Marlboro miles out of the trash, and I bought a Marlboro tent, and I got a tent down at this abandoned oil refinery. And we went down there, and he's like, oh, you got to hear what it sounds like in the, inside the drums. And we went down there, and we had some hammers that we broke the wooden part of the hammer off, and you'd throw the hammer head at the wall, and it sounded like a laser beam. Like, it'd be like, pew! You know, and we're like, this is insane. Like, and he's like, yeah. He's like, so I got this in with this church. They have the second oldest pipe organ or something in the United States. And he was such a, like, he was such a crazy, like, on the schizo affective spectrum somewhere, like, kid, that he'd always get this attention from, like, people like Chris, born again Christians that were like, I'm going to take you in or something like that. He got some in from somebody at this church that he was kind of using them as like an in to be like, they let me go in there and play the organ. And it's like this gigantic pipe organ. So he's like, yo, he's like, we're starting this band called the Sinaholics. We did a noise tape. We never played a show or anything. We did some tapes of just like weird noise cassette tape stuff, but he already had a Sinaholics tattoo. You know what I mean? And I was like, well, I'll get the Sinaholics tattoo once we play a show. But the idea was that we were going to get a portable, some kind of multi-track thing, record beats in the oil drums, then go overdub the pipe organ. You know what I mean? And we're like, oh my God, it's going to be the most amazing thing ever. But of course, unsurprisingly, he couldn't hold it together to like stay in town long enough, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Just for context, Cabby had a full-size bird tattooed on the side of his face where the bird's head went around his eye, and his eye was the bird's eye, and the beak came down onto his nose. And he ultimately cut off his one ear in order to finish the tattoo. So,
well, he did a lot of PCP.
That's the person.
PCP explains a lot of this stuff, you know what I mean?
Yeah, we all played in other bands beforehand. Okay. We ended up playing this band because of the fact that our other bands were all somewhat dysfunctional, because there was always a wild card in the other bands that prevented those bands from having longevity or accomplishing even like the minor goal of like getting the crap to the show or something.
Right.
So like it became obvious that our other bands were too difficult to maintain, and we were just like, we should just be in a band with us, because at least us would get the goal done by...
Not that we were ever, like, super ambitious or anything, but you know what I mean? We could, like, take the equipment to the show and play the show.
The minimum goal of just being like, let's play several shows in a calendar year and
without a bunch of drama and just all the things that you run into when you don't realize when you're young, just, like, the baggage. Like, you know, I remember the band I was in high school, like, the bass player and the guitar player are, like, chest to chest fighting each other, and I'm just like, oh my God, just play the song. Like,
over what? The stakes are so low.
The stakes are so low.
I kind of understand that when you watch the rockumentaries and it's like a rockumentary about Queen or something, and it's like, oh, there's big money coming in and it's like a business, and they're, you know what I mean? But you're like, it's so bizarre to look back on stuff where you're like, the goal is like, you're playing for 20 people, but you still get that now. I mean, you play shows even now, as old as we are, we'll play with younger bands or whatever, and people still are like jockeying to get the best spot on the show where there's going to be 20 people there, and they will, can we wait for a while? Just 10 more people might show up, and you're like,
the drummer from the band's arguing with the keyboard player because the keyboard player's trying to set up the smoke machine.
And yeah, and you're like,
other
no.
guy thinks that's too much effort. I mean, you're like, none of this matters.
I came up with the band name. It was a bad decision. Northern Liberties isn't a good band name. There's a way better. I thought of a band name the other day. I was like, is there a band called No Likes? I put it into Bandcamp. There's not one. I'm like, fuck, I want to call the band No Likes. That's so good.
They could have their next album.
You could have shirts that say No Likes. People would be like, I want that shirt. I didn't even know it was a band. It's so good. But anyways, I was reading a local history book, and it was talking about how the neighborhood name Northern Liberties, which is, as you know, if you're in Philly, is a neighborhood in Philly, that was actually the name of a neighborhood in England. Several neighborhoods, and actually there used to be a neighborhood in Washington, D.C. called Northern Liberties. I think there still is in Baltimore. You know, anyway, it was like a term. And the term, the Liberties in question, were that you had the liberty to not tether your pigs and stuff. You could let your pigs roam in the street and eat the garbage because it was an outerlying part of the city, sort of like a suburb.
Yeah, it was a less governed area.
Less governed. Yeah. So no one gave a fuck what happened there. And it was like, well, that's a great band name for our band because the deal with our band is that no one will ever listen to us or really see us play.
Jeez, I didn't know that.
So therefore...
I might not have joined.
I mean, my expectations were never that thousands of people would be coming see us play. So I was like, it doesn't matter what we do. We have total liberty to be like, we can do whatever we want to do because it's not like we're going to be like, we're making a lot of money. Trips me out. I looked this up on YouTube the other day. I was watching a rockumentary some guy from Germany made about that band, the Bloodhound Gang. I don't know if you remember them. They were like a frat rap band.
I remember the name.
They were a frat rap phenomenon. They'd be on like Howard Stern all the time, and they were those guys' Jackass. Like they'd be like, dipshit Jimmy like kicks the guy in the balls, and then he barfs in a bucket, and like you know the drummer drinks the barf, and then like you know what I mean, like. We had a warehouse. Me and Mark went out and worked on fishing boats in Alaska. That's how we got out of life of homelessness, living in squats and stuff. We came back and we were renting at this warehouse. We had like sort of a punk rock warehouse or something. And like weirdly, because some friends of ours were like friends with those Jackass guys and stuff from back in the day, the one guy that lived with us was the guitar player for that Bloodhound Gang. And we just thought the band was so dumb and stuff. Not that they were even dumber than the dumb shit we were doing, but we were judgy about it, and we were like, they're so dumb, they're so lowbrow, we have no interest in going to see... And he'd always be like, want to come see my band play at, like, the big show? And we'd be like, no. Like,
you know? One thing I'll say I learned from having a room directly next to this person who was the guitar player in the Bloodhound Gang, because it was just one sheet of drywall, and I could hear everything... it really helped me come to terms with understanding that what it takes to be a popular band, and that I wasn't interested in that, because he would be on the phone and the computer like 16 hours a day promoting his band, and I never once heard him talk about the music. I never once heard him talk about anything about music. I never heard him practice his guitar.
All I remember is one time he came home and he's like, he was kind of like Eeyore. He's a little bit downcast, you know? And I was like, hey, Matt, how you doing? Or whatever. He's like, Jimmy made us do a music video, you know? And I'm like, oh, that sounds kind of fun. He's like, it sucked. My knees hurt. I had to jump up and down for like 10 hours, you know?
So like, it really made me kind of be like, oh, the skill of being a celebrity is its own thing, and I'm not interested.
Not
in
that
it.
They were like celebrity,
well,
but they were
like, you know,
he would be like, I gave you the demo tape to Marilyn Manson, you know, whatever.
I mean, Madonna called our house.
She did, that's right. That's fucking weird.
Looking for Matt.
Yeah, looking for Matt. I forget why, but
she wanted to sign them.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, they were, I definitely recognized the name when you said it.
But it was funny because like they'd be playing the truck and they'd be like, "You guys want to come?" And the only time any of us went was Kevin went to shake down Matt for rent money, and he didn't watch the band. He just was like, "Yo, you owe rent. Like, see you later."
I had some mail for him.
Oh, you had some mail for him.
I did go down to the truck, and I was standing on the tour bus with Matt's mail, and he was like, "You want to stay for the show?" And I was like,
Matt was a nice enough guy. I'm not like,
I had stayed for the show now, but I was like, we were young and we were like convinced that what we were doing was so intense, but in reality it was just like really dysfunctional, like introverted weirdness.
Well, I think it may have been weirdness. Both. Yeah. It was intense.
Dysfunctional. It was sort of heartbreaking when I first moved to the city, because like we said earlier, we were in a small town, so like all of the even remotely fringy genres of music or art, all of those kids hung out together because there was only 20 kids total, and so you were going to hang out with anybody who was even marginally out of the ordinary. And so we came to the city with that mindset where we were just like, holy shit, there's hundreds of people who are like, you know, on the fringe. So there's going to be this huge thing. But then we started going to shows at some of those places, and those places became so specifically tight-ass about the genre or the fashion aesthetic that then it was really like you were dealing with the crappy aspects of, like, you know, small-town football team guys or something like that, because they were still, like, bullying you because you didn't
listen to metal.
Yeah, you didn't have
the appropriate
spikes in the appropriate place on your jacket or something like that. But we were, like, you know, doe-eyed optimists about it because we were just like, look at all these weird kids.
And they're going to be down for anything.
And then most of those weird kids were just complete assholes to us because they were like, you're not doing the thing you're supposed to be doing in this weird thing.
Yeah, I mean...
And that was a real bummer to, like, realize that, oh, shit, most of these kids are just, like, the same bullies that you were trying to get away from.
It does seem like, and I don't know if it's the internet to blame or something else, but, like, it does seem like... Back then, like, I'm talking about, like, even, like, mid-late 90s, if you tweaked the formula of the traditional rock band even a little bit, it would blow people's minds. Like, it didn't take much. You know what I mean? Like, if you were just sort of like, okay, we're a chaos punk band, but we don't have a bass player. It's just, like, guitar, and maybe the guitar is, like, a baritone guitar or something, and we got a singer. And otherwise, like, you know, we got mohawks, and we're just whatever. People would be like, dude, I mean... So what's up with, like, when are you guys getting a bass player? And you're like, well, do you really need it? I mean, we got this baritone string on the... No. You know what I mean? It was more, like, rigid in that way. But in a way, it was kind of cool because it just didn't take much to blow people's minds. Like, you were sort... Now it's like, I don't know what you'd have to do to blow people's minds. Like, people are just like... That's the shitty part of it. That's the other downside, is I do feel like at some point there's this, like, jaded cynicism where people are like, I've seen it all. Like, there's nothing
you can do. Well, I don't know. I think, you know, we just... Or at least I do. We just put our focus into live band.
Yeah, and we've always just done our own thing in our own corner. But, like, people can take it or leave it. But it's just something I've noticed. You know what I mean? Like, for sure. Now, I mean, I'd say since, like, the year 2008, maybe Northern Liberties plays a show. I can't remember the last time anybody was like, "Whoa, like, you guys don't have a guitar player." Like. You know,
they probably just gave up there.
It's not, I mean, even back in the Eulogy days, people would be like, "You must worship to the altar of Lightning Bolt," because that was like the one reference point. None of us ever heard that band. I'm not trying to be like, you know, people like, "Oh, you heard them. You're just trying to act cool." I just never really did. I just was like, didn't know about the Providence art scene, or, you know, I just didn't know that stuff. And then the weird thing was, like, years later, when we finally heard Lightning Bolt, we were like, we sound nothing like that. Like, I mean, other than the fact that they have bass and drums, they sound like... And I liked them. I mean, I was like, they're good, but, like, they're, like, improvisational, kind of. They're, like, more... You know what I mean? Like, they're just kind of like... You know?
Right.
And then somebody's like, well, you guys use, like, cardboard props and stuff. And I'm like, have you ever seen our band? I don't think we've ever used a cardboard prop. Like, it's just bizarre. Like, people just... I remember some
I wish we had cardboard.
Some anonymous person on the internet, I don't know who it was, I was looking at some you know, something on the internet years ago, and somebody's like, oh, that band Northern Liberties, and somebody says, oh yeah, they were just always too Burning Man for my taste, you know, with their props and stuff. And I'm like, what? Like, we're... I mean, I don't know. You know what I mean?
Confusing you for somebody else.
No, I don't think so. I think somebody just was like, oh, they're artsy and they got cardboard props and...
Right. Giving us, you know, too much credit for our engineering skills.
I suppose, really. Yeah. We never engineered anything. I mean, I got the trip drums, you know.
But... Yeah, but I think it's, you know, I still enjoy playing live shows, and it's cool that anybody, you know, comes out to check it out. And yeah, I'm just enjoying it.
What do you guys feel like, in general throughout your life, and maybe in particular now that you're, you know, all of us are getting older.
Seasoned rockers.
Yes. what do you feel like is the role of of art in your personal lives?
Well, I would say, and I think I would go back to my, if somebody was like, well, what was, you know, that guy about? I would like say, here, listen to the music. Don't look at my career at, you know, my job, which is fine. You know what I'm saying? But I feel like that and art and music get me through. You know, I would say art, music, and humor probably. I don't think I could get through it.
Gallows humor. You know,
when I started playing music, I thought I was going to like share some intensity that I had. I thought I was going to create this output of this artistic thing that others would appreciate, which I don't think I ever really did, but I became part of like a music scene. And I think that I absorbed a lot of the art thoughts, the inspirational, like, you know, self-determination where you are like creating things for yourself outside of the normal, like, you know, the normal constraints of society. You're having shows in illegal venues, you're recording and releasing albums on yourself, you're doing touring by yourself, and the stuff that I absorbed from the music and art world made me a much better individual and made me have a much more evolved sense of what is possible. And I didn't think that I would absorb. I thought I would secrete.
Secreting intensity.
But, that's intense.
But you
I
know,
feel like that's too intense.
In reality, I think that I got more out of it than other people got out of me. And there's I don't know. I think that's a good thing about a music scene or you know, a duration of time where you drive around the country.
It's that I don't know who the hell said it, but there's that saying that if you stare into the void stares into you.
I think that's Nietzsche.
You know, is it?
Some people say Nietzsche, but it's actually pronounced Nietzsche. I do believe it's pronounced Nietzsche.
Yeah, we're about to get in a fist fight about the pronunciation of Nietzsche.
Nietzsche, Nietzsche, you son of a bitch. We need a third option. I think that was him. They say it was. It might be one of those bullshit things. But. Yeah.
But I would agree with Kevin. I mean, that's definitely been, for sure, you know, I guess you would call it sort of the punk rock approach to things. In some ways, and I think this is something that Justin has said before, I think there's some aspect of vaudeville, I think, in punk rock.
Oh, yeah. It's
like a tradition.
I've been doing a lot of nonfiction research and writing, you know, mostly about like hipsters of 100 years ago or so, you know what I mean? And so I got all like brushed up on what it was like to tour as a musician in the 19-teens. And everything, you know, and of course that era's got all of its fucked up stuff too, like we still have today, you know what I mean? But yeah, I just was like, whoa, like this whole thing where, you know, like Black Flag or something, they're like, if it wasn't for us paving the way through the weeds, you kids, back then we didn't have rest stops, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, people have actually been doing that. People have been touring like DIY, like since, I mean, probably before the Industrial Revolution, like there used to be bards. You know what I mean?
Did we not find in a squat a diary of some girl who was in a vaudeville troupe?
I don't know. I don't. Not me. I didn't find it. Okay. Maybe somebody did. It doesn't ring a bell to me.
I remember reading it, but I don't have a clear memory.
Reed found a practice tape of Green Day. It was like really funny too, because my friend Reed, he's like a super 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 music snob. Like he's one of these people that's just like, yo, I know bands, and I mean all the props to him. I don't mean this in a denigrating way. I mean he knows music where you're like, holy shit, like I never heard of this, like, you know. And I was touring with him, and he was talking to us, and he's like, yeah, I was staying at C Squat or ABC, you know, one of these famous squats in New York, you know, and he's like, I found this tape on the ground and I put it in, and he's like, it was a fucking practice tape of Green Day, you know? And I was like, whoa, like, put that shit on eBay or something. I mean, that's like, I don't like Green Day that much. Kevin's a fan. Like, I like the drums, you know what I mean? But, like, it's just a cool historic find. Like, I'm just like, that's such a cool artifact. Like, you didn't even have to like Green Day. I mean, if I found a Linkin Park practice tape, I'd be like, well, I guess I should digitize it, you know what I mean?
Right.
And he's like, I threw it in the garbage because it was Green Day. But apparently it was them working out a cover of 99 Luft Balloons. Like, he's like, they just kept playing it and fucking it up or something, you know? And I was like, huh, okay, you know?
And how about for you, like, how where would you place art in your personal life as like?
Ooh, that's a hairy question. I mean,
your entire life is art.
Yeah, I mean, because I always did visual art. You know what I mean? And then music and stuff. And it was always like everything else is there to support that. And it never mattered to me. I shouldn't say it never mattered, but I would live my life that way, whether or not there was any material reward. And in fact, have taken, I can't even tell you how many hits because of doing that. You know what I mean? Where it was like, oh my, my life has been knocked down 10 ways till Tuesday because I was like, I couldn't do anything else but like live in service of that stuff. You know what I mean? And it's weird because it's not something that I would really say is like fun. Like, I'm not like, oh, it's fun, like going to the circus, or like, you know, it's enjoyable. It's just, and it's not enjoyable either. Like, I know, I don't understand. I can't relate to it, and everybody's got their own ways, but I can't relate to it when artists, visual or music artists, are like, I can't get the right shade of blue, and like my stuff sucks, and like I got imposter syndrome, and I'm just like, I'm not an imposter. I just got syndrome, you know, I just got the art disease. I actually almost feel like it is a disease, like that it's like a disability.
You're truly a force of nature where you don't really have the ability to turn it off. You're creating.
I mean, it almost sounds always pretentious or something to say it, but it's like, I don't mean it in a totally positive way. Like, I just can't do anything else. Like, it's just the thing that, like, I'm like, I worked on the fishing boats. It was really in service of doing the art. You know what I mean? Like, people are like, oh, that's a crazy job. You must have, I'm like, yeah, the injury rate's 100%. Like, I saw somebody get their fingers cut off, but it was all to like, be like, gotta do the art. So we'd work 3 months of like 17 hours a day, 40 hour offloads. It was like fucking insane. But then you'd get a huge windfall of money and you got your 3 months of like downtime. Like, you know, you'd even collect unemployment. So you'd be like, oh man, I got my like, you know, $15,000 check. Now I'm also collecting unemployment. I got 3 months to just do my art and stuff. And, you know, I just got so into it.
Describe an instance when viewing, hearing, or creating a work of art that has, where it's like produced an incredibly intense reaction. Yeah, Kevin?
All right. I mean, probably my most pivotal intense reaction to seeing music was actually the first time that I met Justin when I was 12 years old. I saw Justin and Mark's band play at the high school in my town, and it was the first time that I had ever seen live music performed, like a rock band. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was for sure the most pivotal time in my life of seeing music performed, because it created the idea in my head that it could be something that you would do for entertainment for yourself. Like, so it expanded my mind for the concept of music and performance.
For me, to answer that question, I just thought of this when Kevin was talking, because I was mostly thinking about playing music or stuff, and then thinking about visual art too, because I do that stuff too. But I actually just thought of this, and I'm glad I did. When I was a kid, I'm talking about like 12, 13, whatever. Our parents had a pretty good record collection, not a big record collection, but they had some good stuff. You know what I mean? Trying to think, speaking of Yoko Ono, a funny thing was, our parents had the Plastic Ono band, where it's John Lennon on one side and then Yoko on the other side. And I used to play the Yoko side all the time. And my dad would be like, "That's how I knew you were insane." Like, he's like, "I never listened to that side." And I'm like, "That side's the fucking gold. Like, you know, it's fucking brilliant." It's like, what the hell? Like, I still think that holds up. I'm like,
John Lennon included that landmine for you.
Oh yeah. And the White Album, I used to love Revolution Number 9. Like, I would play that and I'd be like, "I could do this type of stuff in my bedroom with tape decks and stuff." Like, number nine, you know, "You Become Naked." I'm like, this is fucking brilliant. But
as his brother, I'll say he did do some of that stuff.
Yeah, I used to do noise stuff, and I didn't know any of those asshole noise people, Genesis, Pure Origin, none of that stuff was on my radar. I was just messing around with tape decks because of the Beatles' White Album, and you know what I mean? But the thing that really, like, blew my mind, and like Kevin's saying, made me think, oh, I could do music or something, was that I had a tape deck, a double tape deck little radio in my bedroom with a long antenna on it like that. And we had a tin roof. We lived in a disused barn. We moved to that barn. We didn't have running water or electricity for a few years. And it was this whole thing. We're building up the infrastructure in the barn and everything. We had this huge tin roof. You know how barns have like a massive tin roof. And I was like, I read something in some little book or something about how radio waves are transmitted and received and everything. And I was like, oh shit, I'm going to hook up a copper wire out of my... I didn't have windows in my room, but out of the little door crack, and I'm going to attach it to the tin roof of the barn to my radio. And all of a sudden I could get like numbers stations from the Soviet Union, you know, and like stuff from Mexico. And like I'm like up at night on a cloudless night, listen, like 5, 9, 4, 1, like the hair on my neck.
It would just never stop. It would just be like a series of numbers.
I still have my tapes of it. I would tape it, and I still have those cassette tapes. But the thing that really I got into was there was a Gettysburg College was the closest college to us, and they had a college radio station. And so I would listen to the college radio station, and they would play punk and like noise and, you know what I mean, just whatever the DJs were into. And there was like this one DJ that would always play like the Boredoms and... oh gosh, like just yeah, like the Dicks and like
I can remember having several recorded off of that radio station tapes that I had no idea what any of the bands were. They didn't announce what the names of the bands were, but I knew that on that tape there were like 3 or 4 fantastic songs that I never knew who did them.
Yeah, so I would tape this stuff off the radio station. And then if I'd find a song I really, really loved, like I really loved the Dicks Hate the Police, they played that, and the DJ announced what it was. So I was like, oh, I got to get this. And they'd play Black Flag. And then I would go to the little record store in town in Gettysburg, and they didn't stock any of that stuff, but you could order it through the mail. So I'd get my $5 allowance or whatever and save it up for a couple of weeks and have $10. I could get a tape. Back then, it was all tapes. They were phasing out records. Records were so thin, you couldn't play them. Like, the sound quality was too bad. Right. And compact discs hadn't arrived on the scene yet, so it was all cassettes. So I would order a lot of stuff from the independent labels. I remember being really nervous to order the Riot Girl stuff because I thought they wouldn't ship it to me because I wasn't a girl. So I, like, put Jade or on it or something, you know what I mean? I'm like, I wonder if they'll send it to me, you know what I mean? And they sent it to me, and I was like, oh, cool, I'm incognito. I can get the Bikini Kill tape or whatever. But I was getting all these SST tapes, and there was an SST tape. I ordered Black Flag, Everything Went Black, which is all the, like, early recordings with lots of different singers and stuff. And in the inside of that, there's all these flyers, like all the Raymond Pettibone flyers. And I got a little bit of that Spectrum, you know, the Spectrum stuff they talk about. So I was like real, like, I made a checklist of all the bands on the flyers and alphabetized them and everything. And I was like, okay, I need to find tapes by, you know, Saccharine Trust and Worm and like some of these really shitty bands, but some of them are good too. The Stains, you know, I made a Stains shirt I wore in high school. It says Quit the Human Race. I love that record. And then I would mail order these things from the local record store based on the flyers and the tape. But I mail ordered the tape because of listening to the radio. So I would say listening to the radio, and I've always been an insomniac, so I'd always be listening at like 3 a.m. But that stuff was, and I used to make mixtapes for Kevin then. Like I'd be like, oh yeah, X-Ray Specs and, you know, whatever, all that stuff. You know what I mean? So mail ordering those tapes and stuff. And then I got a big record tape collection, really. I had a few records because sometimes you could only get the thing on record, but I'd rather have it on tape.
And how about you, Mark? Yeah.
So I would say in the time that those two were talking, I thought of three things.
I talked too much.
No, it's okay. In chronological order, the thing that I think made the first big impression on me musically, I got Metallica, the Master of Puppets album, and the song Battery is the first song on that album, and it kind of starts with this acoustic guitar intro, and I'm like, huh, that's kind of weird. And then, like, when that kicked in, I was like, I don't know what the hell this is, but it sounds like how I feel all the time. So that was, like, a thing that sort of started me on that path. So then, you know, I got into a lot of different stuff. I started playing the drums. One thing that made a big change in the way that I approach the drums, there's a book that the drummer from the Grateful Dead wrote called Drumming on the Edge of Magic. And the book is about the role that drumming plays in different cultures around the world and how it's used as like a spiritual way to, you know, in a more spiritual, you know, applications. And it's also, I had never ever been exposed to any like Eastern thinking before. And like that, so it really changed the way that I approached music entirely. So I stopped thinking of it more as like a craft and a technical thing. And I started thinking of it more as a way to reach out and reach inward and explore a spiritual space, as opposed to just sort of like...
Then you hear the Grateful Dead and you're like, this sucks.
Well, yeah, I did hear it and I was kind of like, huh, okay. But the book, I would say, changed my life. Yeah. And then the third thing I'll say...
It works better as an essay than actually like...
Yeah, then you're listening. Yeah. Huh.
You're like, this is like Muzak.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I respect their work ethic of...
Sure.
They played a lot of shows.
I like everything about the Grateful Dead except the music.
It sounded horrible, but they really put in the effort.
Crash Worship should have become like that. Why didn't people...
Well, hey, I'm not here to, you know... I'm just saying that book, like, really changed my approach to things. Separate from their music. And then the third thing that I'll say that I can think of, like a band really changed my life. So in 1994, I was living in an apartment and I had this minimum wage job at an applesauce factory. So if you ever saw Laverne and Shirley, the job where they watch the labels go by, that was my job. And I had this old 1975 CJ5 Jeep. That was missing the muffler. So I went to see Suicidal Tendencies, Danzig, and Metallica at some fairgrounds near where we lived. And I went with another friend of ours. And every 2 miles, we would have to stop and get out of the car because our eyes were watering because there was no muffler and the exhaust fumes would choke us out. Anyway, I got there and watching Suicidal Tendencies and Mike Muir, the singer from Suicidal Tendencies. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things, like, I bet if I went back and looked at it now, you know, like, you hear things a certain way, especially when you're young. But basically what he was saying is, like, if you're going to be happy in this world, you got to make some crazy choices, because if you just take the deal that they give you, you're just never going to be happy. So you have to sort of be, like, suicidal for life. You have to live like you're going to die. At least that's how I remember the whole spiel. And I just decided I was done. I was out. I was leaving. So I got rid of my apartment, quit my job, gave my sweet car away.
That fucking Jeep. There's so many stories about that Jeep.
Yeah. And I moved to Philadelphia. I think I had $120. And I got on a train and moved to Philadelphia. And that was in 94. And I've been here ever since. You know, talking about like, you know, different kind of spiritual experiences when you're playing. One thing that I do like kind of get into in my head is like playing in different places. And I kind of like connect to those places. Like one time we played a show in New Orleans that was in the area that got flooded. And it was the last remaining house that, and they said, you know, like hundreds of people like drowned in their attics because they went up and then the water came up because the levee broke. I don't know. Like, I just feel something like in the, like talking about the oil drums or playing there. One time we played it way out in the middle of nowhere in Virginia, like, that was many years ago.
Virginia Noise Fest.
Yeah. I don't know. There's something about playing like outside in like places.
Yeah. When I was in really, Switzerland,
like, I could feel this like line that goes like, you know, from the past through me to the future.
The one truly psychotic experience I ever had in my life, working on the fishing boats, because we're working like 17 hours a day, 7 days a week. You're doing repetitive tasks all day long. And I had this one experience ever in my life that how people talk about how they had a psychotic break or they had like a religious experience or something. And it was not from smoking PCP and it was not a drug-induced thing or anything, because I've had those things, but they're different in quality, you know what I mean? Right. But the one time I ever had a thing like that, the message was like, you got to do the art, you know what I mean? Like, you got to, like, so it's like, oh, I got to go home and get even more serious about the art.
Tell me about that experience.
Oh, that experience, was just almost the cliche thing that people talk about when they see Jesus or something, except I'm an agnostic kind of person. I'm not even like a spiritual person. I mean, I don't even know what that means when people are like, I'm spiritual. I'm like, what's the spirit? I'm always like, what do you mean? I always want to be like, what does that mean? Define it. If people are like, God, I'm like, okay, what do you mean by God? You know, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm like a skeptical kind of person. But so I didn't even necessarily think, I knew even at the time that I was like, it's my brain chemistry, but there's all this stuff about mind-body duality and what even does that mean? Because how do we even like, we have like subjective experience, but then why am I like, I'm stuff, I'm a bunch of molecules, so is the camera, you know, but why does a living thing feel as if it's got a sovereign existence apart from all the other pieces of things? And that's like a philosophical quandary that's not, doesn't, nobody knows the answer to. And that's totally real. That's just a, you know what I mean? That's not like spiritual. It's just like, you know, so right. I'm putting it in that context, but I was working with my driver partner, Yaya. Yaya was awesome. He taught an African drumming class in Seattle, and we used to play drums on the machine when the machine would break. A pin bone would get stuck in the thing, you know, and we'd play drums on the thing. And I just had one of these things where I was like, oh my God, like, I feel like there's like light coming out of everything, and I'm floating, and there's just some kind of like ultimate, like, just ecstatic, you know, feeling of like oneness with the fucking cosmos, or however you know, all the stuff people say, you know what I mean? But in that was like this message where it was like, you gotta like get more serious about the art. You gotta get home and get, you know, really cracking on the art. And that's, I started doing these bigger drawings on black and white. I did one in a squat that I lived at, this squat where some people died in a fire. It was a Spanish hotel. We used to call it Horror Hotel after the Misfits song. And I did a big ass marker drawing on the wall. My friend Gary actually did some too, similar marker drawings. But I just started doing ones like that on paper and then connecting them. And I've been doing that ever since. So I got a 200-foot drawing or whatever, you know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, I don't know what that is. I guess that's just something that can happen in your brain.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.